From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. For weeks now, the U.S. media has been pointing to the inevitability of Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee and the hopelessness of Bernie Sanders' quest for that slot, despite the fact that outside of the superdelegates listed for Clinton, which number more than 500, the two are relatively close. That contrasts to the treatment by the media of Trump's chances up until this past Tuesday's Indiana primary, where both Ted Cruz and John Kasich, trailing way behind in each case, Trump's campaign, in delegate count and popular vote, were nevertheless held out as possible alternatives at a brokered convention. Any continuing illusion about their possible role as the candidate in November for the Republican Party was canceled out earlier this week.
From the beginning, I've said that I would continue on as long as there was a viable path to victory. Tonight, I'm sorry to say, it appears that path has been foreclosed.
Throughout my campaign, I have said the Lord may have another purpose for me. And it set all the pundits a Twitter. Does that mean he's not committed or he's not focused or he's not energetic? And as I suspend my campaign today, I have renewed faith, deeper faith, that the Lord will show me the way forward and fulfill the purpose of my life.
Regardless of the media attempts to manipulate public opinion here, both Trump and Sanders represent movements among workers in this country that are difficult to ignore and seem determined to be expressed in one way or another. In terms of the economic demands of the two groups, they are strikingly similar and show a unity of interest, if not ideology, among the working class that hasn't been seen since the 1930s. Meanwhile, it seems that the foreign policy consensus that's existed among the Democratic and Republican Party elites since the end of World War II is also being abandoned by millions of voters who have lifted up the Republican frontrunner, despite his rhetorical attacks on both so-called humanitarian interventions in the Middle East and Africa, and the terms of post-war U.S. alliances in Europe and Asia. Meanwhile, with only 8 months more in office, the current U.S. President, Barack Obama, shows no signs of giving up his role as what Margaret Kimberly calls the most aggressively imperialist American president in modern history. She's a columnist at BlackAgendaReport.com, and her latest column under Freedom Rider is entitled Obama's Last Gasp Imperialism. It points to the millions of people in Somalia, Libya, and Syria who were forced to seek refuge abroad by U.S. interventions under America's sitting Democratic president. In addition, she writes, the biggest danger lies in Europe, where the U.S. and NATO continue to provoke Russia in a deadly game that could spin out of control into world war. She points out that only the now apparently inevitable Republican nominee has openly questioned this premise of American foreign policy. We spoke with her about the presidential election, President Obama, and more via Skype Thursday.
There's been so much focus on the upcoming election that very few people have been paying attention to Obama and what he's been doing. And I'm particularly concerned about U.S. relations with Russia, both in Europe and in Syria as well. Obama is the most aggressively imperialist American president in modern history. There's just a swath of destruction all over the world from the Nobel Peace Prize winner. And now, the United States and NATO, and of course, NATO is a complete client of the United States, are being very aggressive towards Russia. The propaganda says that Putin is the aggressor and Putin is evil, and it's just the opposite, in fact. There are NATO troops, first of all, every nation surrounding Russia in Europe, except for Ukraine, I believe, they're all members of NATO. As soon as the Soviet Union disintegrated President, then the first President Bush, and every American president since then has been adding what used to be Soviet bloc nations into NATO or into the European Union. So Russia is now surrounded by its enemies. There are U.S. troops who are doing exercises in Moldova, in places Americans don't think about. Obama is trying to persuade, I believe he has persuaded the U.K., and the Germans are reluctant, but he also wants German troops in the Baltic states. Mm. Now, we're about to celebrate VE Day, as we call it here, or Victory Day, as they call it in Russia, in a few days. And I hope that people remember this 70 years or 71 years after Russia defeated Germany, Obama's asking German troops to be on Russia's border. There is nothing good about this at all. There is no need for it. Well, the only need is for the United States to squash the ability of any nation to stand up to it. And Russia is second militarily to the U.S., and it's the Obama administration desire to make Russia toothless. First in instigating a plunge in the price of oil, which harmed Russia's economy, in maintaining sanctions, and now in literally being militarily aggressive by having NATO troops right on Russia's border.
You know, all of this context that you just started reciting, essentially, is completely left out of a narrative that has Russia, an aggressive Russia, entangling American fighter jets that are, you know, in free space, without mentioning the fact that for the first time since 1945, German troops are deployed again on Russia's borders, and the United States is encouraging further and further such deployments. That there was a summit only last week, a week and a half ago, with Merkel, Hollande from France, Cameron from the UK, Renzi from Italy, and Obama, basically working out this forward-based, quote-unquote, defense, where they have NATO troops all along Russia's borders, NATO membership among all of the buffer states that were essentially agreed upon to protect Russia from Germany at the end of World War II, and these exchanges with American planes taking place not in U.S. airspace over the Aleutians or Long Island or something, but rather right next to Russia.
Absolutely. And let's, just to remind your listeners, Russia has territory in the Baltic. There's a small territory called Kaliningrad. It's wedged between Poland and Lithuania. It is Russia, the way Hawaii is the U.S., the way Alaska is the U.S. So while it's not contiguous with the rest of the country, it's Russia. So Russia has a base, as it has every right to have, Air Force and naval troops in Kaliningrad. So what the media tells us about Russian planes in the Baltic, well, Russia has territory in the Baltic. They have every right to have planes and ships there. And there's no reason for American planes and ships to be in that region. But, and you know, the corporate media are playing a role in, well, they take direct orders from the White House, especially when it comes to foreign policy. Our media just repeat what a president tells them to say. And it's particularly frightening to me at this juncture when we need analysis, when people need to know the truth of what is going on. We get nothing but lie upon lie. And that's been especially true ever since 2014 when the U.S. instigated coup succeeded in Ukraine. Can you imagine if Mexico were having a political crisis and Vladimir Putin involved himself and chose one side over another right on America's border? Can you imagine what the response would be here?
Well, there's
and
actually
yet, the U.S. does the same thing, and then says that Russia is the aggressor.
Yeah, there's actually a piece at Russia-Insider.com, I think it was. I somewhere I saw yesterday. Actually, it was a different website where Joe Lauria was speculating on such an action taking place in Canada, where if there were some sort of a civil uprising in Canada with Russia backing one side and then the United States looking to have the maritime provinces secede and join with the United States, although they have no historical tie legally to the U.S., unlike Crimea. But playing out the scenario that took place in Ukraine in a way that perhaps some Americans could understand.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the fight also extends to Syria, where Putin decided to step in last year and prevent the Assad government from falling. So Russian planes have airstrikes since last September or October have succeeded in stabilizing Assad's regime, but the U.S. won't give up and continues to support the Syrian opposition, so-called. They're terrorists. It's the al-Nusra Front is a branch of al-Qaeda. The U.S., NATO, the Persian Gulf monarch states decided to get rid of Assad and do for Syria what they did for Libya. And Putin, thankfully, finally, after much talk, intervened. But the U.S. isn't giving up. And that is equally dangerous, this poor nation. 9 million people are migrants. And all the stories about people fleeing Syria, no one ever says or rarely says in the corporate media that the U.S. is to blame. All of this human misery is the fault of the United States to create this refugee crisis and then talk about Assad's treatment of his people and make up lies about barrel bombs and so forth. So and now, of course, they lurch back and forth. They could not have the easy victory they hoped to have. So as recently as a couple of days ago, Kerry went back on this rant. John Kerry, the Secretary of State, went back on this rant about Assad having to step down by August 1st. Now, this is ludicrous, but they go through the motions. They are biding their time to see if they can. They don't want to just have their side defeated. I think they still hope to. I suppose Obama hopes his successor will get rid of Assad. But it just goes on and on and on. And it's nothing but imperialism. It's nothing but aggression on the part of the U.S. And it is very, very frightening to me that we have reached this point in the world. And everybody seems to be oblivious to it.
You know, assuming that the pundits are correct here and Hillary Clinton ends up being the Democratic nominee, and that her negatives are less than Trump's in key areas such as among women and Hispanics, for example, making her the presumptive winner in November, there would be a continuity of foreign policy and perhaps not an urgency to for Obama to act in a way to have it happen now. But with Trump making some sounds, for what it's worth, but making some sounds about NATO outliving its usefulness or forcing the Germans, for example, to go from 1.2% to 2% of GDP to provide for their own defense and other things that could sort of shake up the consensus that's been the foreign policy consensus for a long time. And if Trump were to be, for example, ascendant in the polls, do you see, or say if Sanders wins and then he begins to articulate for the first time a foreign policy in opposition to Obama and Clinton's, which hasn't really happened yet, but if these things happen, do you see Obama perhaps jumping the gun and beginning some kind of an adventure against Russia in advance of the election or in advance of next January?
I think it would be dangerous for him to do anything in advance of the election, because that just muddies the waters. He, of course, wants Hillary Clinton to succeed him, and that would be problematic if there were actually a shooting war. There could be one inadvertently. I'm sure in 1914 nobody wanted a world war. No one thought that there'd be millions of people dead in a four-year-long war, but that's what they got anyway. That's my other fear, that by not even by design we could end up in a conflagration. But as far as the election goes, you know, Trump is such an unknown He got a lot of attention for saying a few months ago that he wanted to be even-handed about Israel, but this week he says Israel should build more settlements, so that didn't last long. So who knows what he's going to say about foreign policy, not having had any previous political experience. It's hard to know where he's really going to end up. Sanders, for all his for his reputation as being a socialist, for being very left-wing, is not. Obama sending advisors, a few hundred, to Syria, and Bernie Sanders said that's fine. Bernie Sanders says the kill list is constitutional. So I don't know how much difference we would get with him as a president instead of Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton has a record. It's, you know, she's no worse than Obama, though, but he, you know, with his Teflon, as you know, people may recall, they said Reagan had Teflon and nothing stuck to him, but Obama exceeds him by far. Clinton, of course, being you know, not as slick as Obama, people hate her for killing Gaddafi and laughing about it. Obama's too smart to laugh about it, but she worked for him, so it's something he wanted to see also. So I think whatever happens, if we have a if a Democrat wins the presidency, we have a, definitely have a continuation of the Obama doctrine, and we don't know what we're going to get out of Trump.
Yeah, you know, given all of that, you have beneath both Trump and Sanders some constituencies who do feel and poll quite differently. And although they have not gelled into any kind of a political force up to this point, or at least up until the beginning of the election cycle last year, and the anti-war movement here more or less went to sleep with the election of Barack Obama, is it possible that those playing inside baseball could see the ascendance of either Trump or Sanders as having the potential to express that sentiment, even if they're dragged there by their constituents at some point, and again forcing Obama's hand?
It's hard to say. You know, Trump has so many, he's such a mixed bag. His foreign policy is more like mine. He's actually expressed things that I have said that no Democrat would say. But the rest of his policies, the very open racism, the white nationalism, would, I think, will keep people who otherwise would be supportive, some people who otherwise would be supportive, from excuse me, from supporting his candidacy. So I don't really know. It's hard to say. This, you know, the whole election is just such a crapshoot now. I am unwilling to make any predictions about what's going to happen. I think, but we have to remember, whatever happens with Trump or Clinton or Sanders, even Obama is president until January 20th, and it's going to be his decisions and his actions which determine the future.
Well, as you mentioned with respect to Syria, for example, August 1st is well in advance of that.
Yes, yes, it is. I don't think it means much. I think it's a stalling tactic to make sure that they're the forces that the U.S. government are supporting win, or at least continue the stalemate with Assad. They want to prevent an outright Assad victory. And Assad was on the way to that when Russia intervened. So I don't know if this red line or this date, I don't think it means, it means nothing, really.
And in terms of that Russian intervention, by the way, just to mention that ancient concept, international law, the Syrian very quaint. Syrian government is acknowledged by the world at the United Nations as being the legitimate government of Syria, warts and all, as some see it. But they are the legitimate government. Bashar al-Jafari is recognized as the permanent representative of the Syrian Arab Republic and given voice at the Security Council and elsewhere when matters pertain to Syria presented there. And Russia came in at the invitation of the Syrian government, which is a legitimate way of entering a country and conducting military operations. That is not the case with the United States in either Syria or Iraq. And
correct.
I'm wondering why that seems to escape the attention of the media as they run their narrative.
Well, because they're handmaidens of the government. That's why. They work hand in glove together. And I don't think If you read the New York Times or the Washington Post, I don't think any of them have ever stated that very simple fact, that Putin is the one following international law in Syria, not the United States. It's the United States that's violating the laws that America claims to follow. So the U.S. is the rogue state here. The U.S. is the state-sponsored terrorist. But we'll unfortunately never see that in the media. They go right down the line with the White House and the State Department and whatever they say. And this means that the American people are going to be, the masses of people will be incapable of determining truth from fiction when there will be some sort of spark. Could be intentionally, could be not intentionally, but you cannot have Russia surrounded by U.S. troops. You cannot have Russia and the U.S. fighting with proxies in Syria and not have some incident that brings the world to a hot war, a shooting war. And when that happens, most Americans won't even know to question what their government is telling them.
Now, one of the things that seems to drop under the radar in the American media as well is the continued movement towards military cooperation between Russia and China, who are now conducting actually anti-missile coordinate drills in response to U.S. military activity in the South China Sea and off the Korean Peninsula. And I'm wondering if this conflagration that we're risking couldn't really globalize very quickly.
Oh, it could. And, Russia hasn't been sitting back waiting to be beaten up by the U.S. and NATO. They obviously are looking out for their interests, and they have formed a strategic alliance with China, all sorts of economic agreements, military agreements. So you are correct. This could lead to a larger crisis, and it's very eerie to me. It looks like the world looked 100 years ago when various alliances led to the First World War. So it's important to remember we may not be, our media may not tell us anything about Russia and China, but absolutely, they are very closely linked, and anything that affects either of those countries with the U.S. will affect the other one as well.
And, of course, you have the U.S. taking an aggressive posture towards China, not just Russia with these encounters with fighter jets and naval vessels and such, but an actual provocation on occasion from time to time by the U.S. Navy and U.S. Air Force against China's military.
Yes, and China responds by being expansive in its part of the world, with angering its neighbors, building these artificial islands. Someone has to explain to me exactly how you do that. But anyway, in the South China Sea, near the Philippines and other countries, who the United States then tries to use as allies against China. So the U.S. forces, troops left the Philippines. There are no longer large military bases in the Philippines, but now they signed an agreement allowing U.S. troops to be there temporarily. So they are expanding this fight into everybody's neighborhood, and it puts the whole world at risk.
You know, you have the U.S. driving gunpoint alliance of traditionally hostile powers like Japan and the Philippines, for example, and Japan and Korea, given the history just of World War II, for example. On the one hand, joint drills with Japan and the Philippines, joint actions between Japan and South Korea as well. And on the other hand, you have Trump again discussing Asia policy, saying, you know what, let's cut them loose if they don't pay their fair share and let everything shake out the way it shakes out there.
Yeah, it's, there's still the bottom of that, of what he says about letting other countries pay their fair share, there's still this assumption that these countries ought to be vassals of the U.S. and ought to help us do something. What I would like to hear is for him to say there's no reason for NATO to exist at all, instead of saying Germany and Britain ought to pay more, instead of saying other countries ought to pay more. What should happen is for someone to say that America has no right to be the world's police force and has no right to interfere in the affairs of other countries. That's what I would like to hear. But I think by even bringing this up, Trump calls into question the entire imperial project, and it gives people space to talk about things that most other presidential candidates would not talk about. So I think there is some positive value. I guess there's it's true, there's no, what is it, it's an ill wind that blows no one some good, so I guess we even have to be grateful to Trump for that.
I'm looking underneath Trump and Sanders again, finally. Their potential on certain issues for unity among the working class, with all the contradictions that exist, the race, of Islamophobia, of the whole religious weight that's weighed down the working class inside the Republican Party. The wiggle room, for example, presented by Trump on foreign policy, and the wiggle room presented by both Trump and, more particularly, Sanders in terms of economics, leaves at least the potential for the working class to move forward through that morass. The task, of course, is finding the path. What do you suggest that people should be looking at?
Well, I think what we should be looking at is the fact that Trump is sometimes, in all his craziness and his racism, sometimes says things that Democrats used to say as well. His questioning of the trade deals, his support of working Americans and their ability to earn a living, a living wage in this country, to stop the race to the bottom. Those were things that Democrats used to say. And it's a reminder to us how little the Democrats do for working people. You know, everyone talks now about the $15 an hour minimum wage. In 2009 and 2010, Democrats controlled both houses of Congress and the White House. And the minimum wage in 2009 went up a grand total of 70 cents, not even $1. And I think we need to remember this as the election approaches and stop acting like the most horrible thing is to have a Republican victory. It's Democrats who carry out the neoliberal agenda. So what do we do with someone like Trump? I think what we do not do is to back Hillary Clinton and allow her to treat him as the bogeyman. I think the thing for working people to do and on the left to do is once and for all end the Democratic Party. No more support for the Democrats. They are of no use to us. The two-party duopoly has been an absolute disaster. We have Democrats every 4 years pretending to be something that they are not. After 8 years of Obama, we don't have card check. We have a meager minimum wage. There has been very aggressive foreign policy, and they don't even take care of us with domestic policy. So enough. I hope people stop worshiping Bernie Sanders, because there isn't that much there. He's just a Democrat. That's all he is. Hillary Clinton is obviously awful, so we can't support her either. So people need to start saying, and not passively, not just to say I'm not going to vote, not just to say I don't care if Trump wins, but actively work towards bringing about an alternative to the Democratic Party.
And on your Facebook page, you've posted that you intend to vote for Jill Stein, going along those lines.
Yes, absolutely. I said that all along. I was going to vote for the, she's not officially the nominee yet, but the Green Party candidate for president. I'm still registered as a Democrat. That's more inertia than anything else. But even though I'm registered as a Democrat, I did not vote in the recent New York primary because I don't want Hillary Clinton or Bernie Sanders to be president. It's time to stop fearing the spoiler boogeyman. It's time to stop letting the Republicans, and especially now Trump, be used to frighten us. It's time to get rid of the Democrats. There's no hope for us unless we get rid of the Democrats.
Margaret Kimberly, who pens the weekly column Freedom Rider, thank you for your time. A pleasure as always.
Thank you so much, Don.